welcome to a Listen to Older Voices Golden Moments program. I'm brought to you through the Toorak Times. This is a repeat program from our archives that we believe has merit enough to rebroadcast so that the story and the person's life can be shared with those who may have missed it the first time. Hello, I'm Rob Greaves, and welcome to Listen to Older Voices, and part two of a three-part program featuring the life and times of Bev Gould. We learned in part one that Bev, born in 1941, was looked after predominantly by her grandmothers, as her mother worked to help in the war effort, and she failed to have a father home and into her life during her formative years due to him fighting in World War II. This had a major impact upon Bev, and even though her father found reintegration back into his family difficult, it didn't stop Bev from striving for his affection. Whilst she strongly enjoyed her own company, she also enjoyed school and desperately wanted to matriculate and become a teacher. But due to financial hardships and her father's attitude to educating women, she was forced to leave school at 15. This week, we learn how she met her husband-to-be, John, and what life was like for her as an office worker. Listen out for her description of her near-death experience. It leaves you pondering. We also learn why it was and how she came to go back to high school in normal day classes as an adult with children. We pick up now with Beth talking about her near-death experience.
I also had a wonderful experience, which was a near-death experience, which enabled me to see that I was more than my body, and put a lot more things into, like, if I had died, I wouldn't have died. My body, well, would have been not me. So I was able then to look at a whole different aspect of life and to also think that I had a second chance. Now, going through that made it a time where I also was going, I went through an adolescence, which was quite strange, I suppose.
Is this, do you think, because you didn't really have an adolescence?
I didn't really have one.
Yes.
I didn't
yes.
have one.
No, you went straight from a young girl into working out.
And to pleasing my parents.
Mm.
And my mother had become alcoholic by this time.
Mm.
My dad was workaholic. And I was there to sort of, try and bridge the gap, try and make people happy. And my role of being the peacemaker, the one who tried to make the family proud and somehow just make them feel normal. But then I went on with my own family and I created, when I was 20, I got married. And
before you get there, because the age of 15 must have been, what, middle 50s by now?
Yeah, 56.
50, 55, 56.
Yeah, the year of the Olympics in Melbourne.
That's supposedly a time of life of excitement and adventure as a teenager, but it sounds like you've gone straight into work.
Yeah.
Did you miss out on all that socialisation of that age group and mixing with boys?
You were allowed. No, I did have. I had a boyfriend. You were allowed. I was allowed to go out with boys, and I was also very attached to the church in those days because that gave me a place to be that was safe.
Okay.
Yeah, emotionally.
Right.
Where I could be accepted and valued as a person, and I used to sing in the choir, and in fact, I met my husband. We've been married 46 years, and I met him in the local church choir, so that was nice.
And his name?
John.
Think back to when you first met John. Was it a matter of going, oh, I really want to know more about you, I want to go out with you, or did that take time to develop?
I saw him as being a very, very kindly person, and he was very good at dancing. He was a wonderful dancer, and I suppose I didn't actually start going out with him at that time.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until I was 18 and had gone out with some other boys that I sort of came back to going out with John. So that was a good thing.
What sort of dancing did you do?
Oh, ballroom dancing. Ballroom. We won some prizes.
Is that right?
Yeah, we were good. You wouldn't think so now, but we did. We love dancing.
Do you dance still?
We used to. But we both sort of have got, like, I've had three little strokes and John's got a problem with his ankle. So
just physically getting harder now.
Yeah, but
I think it's called getting a little older.
There's nothing wrong with that. I can still dance in my mind. I can tell
that's
you.
That's important, isn't
I can
it?
Look at Dancing with the Stars or whatever and I can be there. right with it.
So did John have a car when you started to go out, or was
he did, mm-hmm. a little tiny Ford Prefect he had. So and he just turned 21. His father had passed away suddenly when John was 13,
mm-hmm.
and they had they had nothing. They'd sold everything up, and his father was born in England. They were going back to England. So John had a hard time. He was an only child, and so his job was then to sort of look after his mum. My job had been to look after my mum.
I was going to say, there's a bit of a parallel.
Oh, there is. There is. And so we teamed up together. Really, not really knowing that. And it was only hindsight we're looking at that. But we made a good team. And because, you know, we've been married all this time. And you look back and you think, it's amazing that nowadays you can think, why did I marry him? Well, because he was kind, he was gentle, he was, I don't know, I knew that he had a good future because he's into electronics. And electronics was very new at that time.
Definitely.
And I suppose that I was money interested. Well, I think say money, but it's not that. What I wanted was a family. I wanted to be able to get married, have children, create a loving family that was more loving than one I'd come out of.
You were looking for more than you had.
Yeah, quite
a reasonable thing to want.
Yeah. And there was this stupid song that was out at that time called Say Sarah Sarah, Whatever Will Be, Will Be.
When I was just a little girl, I asked my mother, what will I be? Will I be pretty? Will I be rich? Here's what she said to me. What will be.
They sang it and played it all the time. And I used to say, no way, Jose.
We're going to accept that.
No way. I'm not going to believe that, you know. I'm not going to say my life's just all mapped out for me. Good it's going to be the way I want it to
be. Yes.
Hey, set off, set off. Whatever will be, will be. The future's not ours to see. Que será, será. What will be, will be.
Listen to Older Voices. Revisiting through recollections.
Were you still working at that point?
Oh, yeah.
In office work?
Yeah.
Tell me, given you had this sort of inquisitive mind from a very young age and able to pick things up, did you ever find the office work challenging or...
No, easy peasy.
So it wasn't something that you really threw yourself into? You did it because you had to?
Just easy, yeah.
Just easy.
Yeah, I just did it, you know. You didn't have that many choices in those days, in the 50s.
No.
You know, and I did it because, I suppose, and I worked in the city, so it was good fun to catch a train, go to the city. I was saving for my family, for my house, even as a youngster. You know, I walked down to the shops in the city, rather than pay sixpence for the tram, because I wanted to save money.
Fair enough.
So by the time I was 20, got married, and I'd been getting £8.7 and 6, which I gave my mother £4.2 and 6. 2 and 6 was for the telephone. And I had saved £300.
That was a lot of money.
It was a lot of money.
Yes.
And I also had quite a number of things that I'd bought second-hand, pieces of furniture, which I was very happy about.
Was your first house together?
Keysborough. We built a house in Keysborough.
So you built your first house you built?
We built. We had built.
Yes, you had built.
And I'm proud to say, I had the keys to our first house for my 21st birthday.
That's quite an achievement. I mean, that's an achievement today, let alone in the 50s.
Mm.
You must have been very proud and pleased, yeah, pleased with what you achieved. It. Yes.
But I did that for my kids. I didn't have any kids at that time.
No, but you
but I wanted to be able to have a home. My mum, God bless her, I mean, she did the best she could, but she had to go to work when I was little.
Yes.
I didn't have my mum with me when I was a baby and when I was a little girl. And I had my grandmother's, but it's not the same, is it?
No, it's not.
And so I didn't want to be a working mother. I wanted to be able to stay at home and be with my children. And I always have been. So, and I'm not glorifying that. That's just the way it worked out.
Mm.
And John was happy for me to do that. And as it turned out, he ended up earning enough money that we could manage on one wage.
So in what year was your first child born?
64. Well, I was married in 62. Paul was born 64, then Angela in 67 and Vanessa in 72.
Your first child, I mean, they always said the first child's special.
Yes.
That must have been a fairly momentous moment for you.
Oh,
you've always wanted children.
It
must have been really special.
It was. And when they handed him to me, and they actually went away and they left him there, you know, when I'd just given birth to him. And I was holding him, you know, and he looked like a little wise old man. And even the health centre sister used to say to me, you know, Mrs. Gould, your baby's going to bring you up more than you bring him up. But, yeah, I just adored him and still do. And I'm very proud of the three of my kids. So
mm-hmm. What was life like for you at that period of time? Because the early 60s, it was people now tend to look back at that period as quite an evolutionary time in terms of change. Were you aware that that was going on?
Yes and no. Yes and no. I think about the colours that we painted our house. Mm-hmm. Now, think about that's colours are important to me anyway. But and I suppose that's one of the reasons, you know, that I'm an artist. But I was 20, John was 23, when we built our first house. And the colours that I had in the kitchen were quite psychedelic. The kitchen cupboards were a bright green and alternated with a rich sort of lipstick pink.
That would not have been out of place by 66, 67, that's for sure. You're always ahead of your time, weren't you?
Look, I've always been ahead of my time. And that's not a good place to be. Because, you see, if you're ahead of your time, people think you're a bit of a weirdo.
Yes.
And then eventually, whatever it is, becomes commonplace, you know.
That's right.
And you sort of sit there thinking, yeah.
You've been there, done that.
I'm with a motley. What's next? But it's exciting. Look, I wouldn't have missed anything in my life. I just love it all.
Right.
It's been very rich. There have been lots of ups and downs. I've been through, you know, very deep depression after I had Vanessa and had this near-death experience.
I was going to want to come back to that and see whether you're comfortable talking a little bit more about that.
Sure.
First of all, how did it come about and what actually happened?
Okay, Vanessa was an emergency cesarean because they couldn't get her heartbeat.
Mm-hmm.
And so they decided to, I personally think, not looking back, that they thought that she'd already gone, you know, passed away. But she hadn't, and girls are quite resilient, you see. Girls will often survive. So, and she hadn't, but it had left her with this brain problem.
Mm-hmm.
Well, lack of oxygen to the brain.
Yes.
And so she has problems with reading and writing. But, you know, she's the most wondrous person, the most loving soul, and I really believe she's an old soul that's come to teach John and I how to love unconditionally, because she loves unconditionally, so we try.
I mean, I'm sure other people would come up with other things that are more important, but really, is there anything more important than unconditional love?
No. That's it. That's the jackpot. If you get that, you've hit the jackpot.
Yes. So, again, how did this out-of-body experience come about? Or near-death experience, rather?
Yeah, well, they did the cesarean,
mm-hmm.
And somewhere, I mean, nobody ever told me exactly what happened because, of course, you could sue them, which we never really thought about. They said to me, no, I mustn't have any more children, and so therefore they would do a sterilisation process, anyway, I can't remember what they called it, so that I didn't have any children anymore. And so they did that. But I think that somewhere in the within it all, somehow I was bleeding internally. I know that. So I was dying of losing blood internally. And I suddenly woke up in the night. But Vanessa was born at 9:30 in the morning. And then somewhere, didn't know anything what happened through that day. Somewhere in the night, I woke up. And because something inside my mind said to me, you must breathe. You haven't breathed. And so I took a breath. And then I started to be aware of taking breaths. And I became aware that I was sitting up, had pillows all around me and pillows under my arms. And I was sitting up straight. And that perspiration was running down my face. But that I was incredibly weak. I could not lift a finger. I could not open my eyes. I could not speak. But inside my mind, I was very much alive.
Mm.
And then I saw, and this probably sounds strange, which is what happened, I saw my Nana, who had passed on only 3 weeks before. And she was a young woman when I'm looking at her. And she was turning around very lightly on her feet, and every time she'd come look at me, she beckoned and smiling. But something in me, which I think is my will, I believe that that's all I had left. Everything, my outer extremities, my senses, everything else was gone except my will. And my will chose not to go. I didn't think about my newborn child or my husband or my other children. Didn't think anything at all about that. I didn't pray, although I'd been quite a religious person. I just observed. And I observed myself and what was going on. And eventually Nana went away, realising I wasn't coming.
It was almost like you were given the option of making a decision at that point.
Yeah, I do think so.
Yes.
But yeah, I'm glad I made the decision not to go.
Well, I am too.
There's always
this would indeed be a strange interview.
It would be.
So this point when you made this decision not to go with her, did you actually regain consciousness at that point?
It took a while. Because then what happened was I was aware that the nurse kept coming in.
Right.
And I don't know how often they come around, but I did see a nurse come in 3 or 4 times. And I decided I was going to try to communicate with her. So I felt that if I put all my energy or will into my forehead, what someone would call the third eye, and beamed it at her, maybe she'd take notice. So I did that, and I'm more or less beaming at her, you know, look at me, there's something wrong. Anyway, she did. And she looked at me, and then she bustled away very bit quickly and brought the doctor, and the doctor tried to get the blood into me, but my veins had sunken down, and I kept them snaking out and going everywhere, and I could see it all. I knew what was happening.
You knew what was happening, or you could see it?
I could see it.
As a third person
as
watching?
As a third person watching. Goodness. I was sort of above myself watching.
Right.
And I also knew at that time that I was very, very much loved. That I was, you know, if I had passed on that minute, I was very much loved. And this idea, I mean, I didn't see Jesus or God or angels or anything. Mm. All I knew was that I was surrounded by this glorious, pulsating, warm, golden, pink light. And it loved me. And all was well with the world, really. But it was only when I came back into my body that I felt pain, and I felt overwhelming, excruciating pain at that time. And then after that, it was quite a long journey to become well again.
I can only begin to imagine. Mm. Yes. So it was. A long time in hospital, a long time recuperating?
A long time recuperating. Because, yes. And I couldn't, there were times when I couldn't walk properly. And I suspect now, when I look back, that maybe I had one of these little strokes then.
Yes.
Because I couldn't keep my balance.
Right.
But it didn't occur to me. I was only 30.
Yes, indeed. Mm. I mean, that's still young.
Yeah, and right. A stroke was wouldn't have thought of it.
Listen to Older Voices. The magic of memories. Where Rob Greaves is talking with 67-year-old Bev Gould.
But I couldn't keep my balance. Eventually I did go to learn yoga, and that was a turning point of my life. And I don't, unfortunately, I haven't kept up the practice, but that taught me a lot of things. It taught me about meditation. I met a lot of very interesting people. We started up a meditation group, and they also did taught painting at this particular place where I was going to do my yoga, and I started to learn to paint. And I took up where I'd left off at high school, and I began to believe that I had a second chance, and this time I was going to get it right.
And is this which triggered you off going back to school?
Yes.
Well, it did.
Well, I'd always wanted to be
a
teacher.
Yes, that's right.
And so I thought, well, why not?
So was this at night school you went to, or what?
No, it was a day school. I went to high school.
That would have been a very interesting experience because, I mean, to put it bluntly, you would have been a lot older than kids around you.
Yeah, I was.
How did they feel? How did they react?
Well, some of them loved me. Some thought I was a pain in the bum, I think. But and the same with the teachers.
Yes.
You know, some liked me and some really wished I wasn't there. What happened was that I'd always felt I'd love to have been a teacher. And when Vanessa started going to school, first of all, she went to the mainstream school because I was hoping, against hope, that she'd be able to cope in a mainstream school. So at that time, and in the April, was just before Easter, and I said to the teacher something about, she said, oh, you would have made a good teacher. And I said to her, that's the last time I'm going to hear somebody say that without doing something about it. And so I went home, it was a Friday, went home after taking Vanessa to school, and sat down at my kitchen table, banged my fist on the table, I said, that's it, I'm going to do something about it. So I went over to my local high school and asked to speak to the principal, and he came, and here's this 36-year-old standing there.
About the same age as you.
And I said to him, look, I've always had this dream. I've always wanted to be a teacher. Could I possibly do my HSC here with the 17 and 18-year-olds? And he said, well, I don't see why not. So he was wonderful. So by that day, and I was all booked in. So I only had to do three subjects, being, you know, a mature age student. So I did English expression, and then English literature and art history. So I ended up getting an A for English expression, which was tremendous. And I passed the other two. I didn't do brilliantly, but I did pass quite well. And that set me up for a lot of things in my future, particularly the art, and because I went on, you know, to have an art gallery.
Well, let me ask you about that. Before I do, what was your family's reaction to you going back to school like that?
Well, my husband and kids were really good. Well, they knew what I was like. Mm. You know, they knew I was an inquisitive type person. And my older children, the first two, Paul and Angela, were already, like, they hadn't quite moved into secondary. I think Paul might have been going to tech school. I think Angela was probably in grade six. And they were fine. But what I had to do with my studies was I had to wait until they'd cleaned. We only had a small house, 11.5 squares. So I'd have to wait until they had tidied the kitchen after tea. And then I could study because we only had a lounge room in the kitchen. And I could study then. So it was a bit hard to actually get around and be able to do my studies. And the other thing was that I didn't start until around about Easter time and in the year. And, of course, they'd already done a heck of a lot.
3 months at least.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so I had to catch up on all of that. So, but I did.
And a feeling of achievement when you finished
it. A big feeling of achievement.
Yes. But never went on to become a teacher.
I didn't. No.
Was this by circumstance or choice?
Choice. Because, well, one thing, I probably would have had to go away from home.
True.
And secondly, by the time I'd finished my year and done my HSC, I realised that Vanessa was going to have to go to special
and
education.
And you had to give her the support she needed.
Absolutely. Yes. But not only that, I realised that special education had problems of its own. And then I went on to become parent advocate at all the various technical schools.
Is this out of frustration of the way that the system dealt with your daughter?
Yes. Very, very definitely.
Did you have any success?
Yes. As far as my role became to be the parent representative on all of the councils to do with further education beyond 15. Interesting age, isn't it?
Keeps coming up.
For people with mild intellectual disabilities within the TAFE system, within the TAFE.
Right.
And so I even was parent representative on the TAFE board.
Was there a lot of resistance to people with, be they even mild disabilities, going into the system then, or was it becoming accepted?
No, it wasn't really accepted.
That doesn't surprise me, the answer.
No. There was a push. The push was beginning, and it wasn't really looked on with pleasure from the people to do with special education either. And, you know, I often think that it went too far.
Please join Bev and myself next week for the conclusion to her story. We learn about how she came to represent the voice of disabled persons in the TAFE system, and how her love for art led to a 14-year love affair with an art gallery that she and her husband John bought. Next week, all this and more on Listen to Older Voices. Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program on behalf of Uniting Victoria Tasmania. The program is funded from the Commonwealth and State Government's Home and Community Care Program and is brought to you through the Toorak Times.